Well, our Torah portion begins in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 18. The name of this portion is Shoftim, which means judges. And in Hebrew it says, Shoftim v'shotrim titein lecha b'kol sharecha. Judges and officers shall you appoint in all your gates. And that's about as far as we're going to get into our Torah portion this morning. I got that far. I read the whole thing. I went and studied the whole thing, but it kept coming back to this phrase. It kept speaking to me. And I'm thinking, this is where we tend to fall flat. This week, for some reason, I was going through my prayer journal. I don't know that I've ever picked this up and just gone straight through it from beginning to end. I started this prayer journal, I'm thinking about 12 years ago. About 12 years ago, and it's about two-thirds full. And what it is each month I put the month of the year and the prayer request, just usually one line apiece for a prayer request. And then the next month I put the month of the year and so on. It goes all the way back over 10 years. And then when a prayer is answered, little red check mark. Okay, little red check mark. And there are many pages here where there are little red check marks beside every single prayer request. And a lot of you have your names in here for prayer requests you've shared. I was reading through this. I was really enjoying it. And I was coming to one. I forget exactly what year it was, but Bill and Kathy Torgler were requesting prayer as to whether they should go to China to adopt a little girl. And three little girls later, you know, I think God definitely answered that prayer. Occasionally, there's a little tombstone because God took someone away, and I put the date of their death. Sometimes we pray, and you know, and it's God chooses not to bring a healing. He chooses to bring the ultimate healing. Instead of repairing the old body, he gives him a brand new one, you know, and that you can't beat that. So I look at those as prayer answers as well. But there are some names in here that have an X beside them. Now, these are people, some of them were people who came and were part of Beth Tikkun for a while. Some were just visited shortly, just came through the doors and kind of left. Others are people who I've met outside of Beth Tikkun, have had nothing to do with this congregation. So they're people from all over. And these are people who either expressed a real problem in their lives, a real character problem, or else they came in and it was just so obvious there was a real character problem. I put their names in here and prayed for them. And over the years, as these people went out of my life, when I saw there's no change, I put an X. Doesn't mean I don't pray for them, but it means God said no. There's no change. I went through and I made a list of these people. And about 20 or plus names on there. You want to know who they are? Oh, you're bad sheep. You're bad sheep. No, you're not going to find out. That's a secret. But I noticed that there were a few things all of them had in common. First of all, they all claimed to be believers. In fact, some of them are very vocal about it. Some have even pursued ministry. Another thing they all had in common is that none of them, and this is important, none of them recognized authority in their lives. None of them. They all had a problem with authority. They recognized no authority. And the other thing, and maybe it's the same as the one I just mentioned, they did not recognize who their enemy was. They all had enemies, and they wanted prayer against their enemies. But they never recognized truly who the enemy was in their life. And these people all have X's. Some of them, now there are a couple people on the list who are truly wicked people. They were wolves, or are wolves, wherever they're at now. Wolves in sheep's clothing. Claim to be believers, you know, boast about being believers. But they weren't here to feed on the word. They were here to feed on the sheep. And once they were recognized, once they're identified by the leadership here, we never had to say anything to them. They just left. Just went. Some of them were totally dominated by emotion. That was a problem with many. They were under the tyranny of their own feelings and emotions. But not all. Almost all of them had a trail of broken relationships. Most, except for, I think, two exceptions, of the ones who were married during the time I knew them, they got divorced. Some of them had been divorced before they came in. And not that you're a bad person if you're a divorcee. No, I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying with the problems they had, marriage simply will not flourish. It just simply won't. But they didn't recognize authority. And, you know, I just happened to pick my prayer journal up and go through it, and then I was reading this, and then I put two and two together. Judges and officers shall you appoint in all your gates. Now, this is not God speaking to Moses, saying, Moses, I want you to appoint officers and judges over the people. This is Moses speaking to the people, saying, you establish judges and officers in your gates. In other words, you find someone who is a good authority, someone who's wise, someone who's trustworthy, and you appoint them in your gates. In other words, your gates. What are your gates? Your eyes, your ears, right? The things that come into your head, the things that come into your mind. And I want you to find authorities and set them in your gates. And you bounce things off of them and you trust them. Please don't hear me at all this morning saying, God has established me as your authority, you must do what I say. If I ever say that, run. Okay? In fact, I'll be leaving too. I'm going with you. Don't ever do that. Anybody who establishes themselves as the authority over the... No. Sorry. We just don't do that. But you are commanded to establish authorities in your lives. Don't pick somebody who's too close of a buddy. They'll always see the eye to eye with you. Pick someone generally who's older. Pick someone who's not emotional. Pick someone who knows the word. Pick someone who has fruit in their lives. Someone who has discipline in their lives. Someone who's reliable, whose marriage is good, whose relationships are solid, and generally is stable in their lives. And go to them and say, I would love to appoint you as an authority in my life. Would you be an authority to watch my back, to hold me accountable, And to let me know when you see my life veering from the Word of God, when you see me being controlled by things that are not in line with God's Word, would you please bring those to my attention? You know, when God made us, notice he put eyes in the front of our heads. We're not like squirrels and horses with them on the sides that can see kind of all around us. They're right in the front, which means I can't see the back of my head. I've never seen the back of my head. It might be my best feature, and I don't even know it. I don't know. I've never seen my back. I can look down. I can see my front. Can't see my back. I have to rely on other instruments and other people to let me know my blind spots. And we all are, you come into this world with the blind spots built in. It's interesting when you see Yeshua in Revelation, where John is in the heavenly court, and he hears a voice, behold the Lion of Judah. And he turns around and he says, I saw a lamb as it had been slain and had seven eyes all the way around. Yeshua had no blind spots. We don't have that advantage. We simply don't have that advantage. And so as I was going through my prayer journal and thinking about these souls, gifted souls, many of them, filled with potential, and yet their lives shipwrecked. Their lives ineffective. Their lives causing more damage in the lives of others instead of good. A couple comes to mind. Precious couple. You'd love them if you met them. But weak. Dominated by feelings and emotions. Unable to really tap into God's word and read what it says and then apply it to the lives. It seems like that ability was just broken. And so here's a guy who is a husband, but not truly a man. He's a father, but not truly a leader. A believer, but not truly a disciple. And you can't appeal. You can't get through. just, it's like a Teflon believer. Everything just rolls off. Nothing penetrates. And I could go on and on and on. How does this happen? How does this work? You know, several months ago when we were studying Leviticus, I was discussing the ego with you, and I almost didn't do it. I thought maybe this would be boring to the people, yet I know so many people have requested that teaching. Not because I'm a great teacher or anything, but because it's great information. And I had underestimated how powerful that information was in all of our lives. And after the teaching, I started thinking, you know what? That I'm glad I did that, because it kept speaking to me. I was sharing about the ego. And I want to review a little of that, but then I want to take that teaching further. Because I think we all have real misconceptions about what the ego is. We think ego is pride. I have news for you. It's not. It can be a source of pride. But the ego is not defined as pride. The word ego, ego, is a Greek word. It means I, me. And it's found throughout the Greek New Testament. This means I. In Hebrew, the word's ani. We'll look at that in a moment, too. It's just a word that means I, me. And there are five symptoms I shared with you before, symptoms of ego in daily life. Number one, the ego is all about making myself right and others wrong. In other words, it equates yourself with what you think. You always hear, you are what you think. Not true. Sometimes what you think and what you are worlds apart. And that's where all your misery comes from. Number two, the ego causes feelings of superiority or inferiority. Either one. It's a constant need to maintain the boundary of self, and that's the important definition of ego. It is a phantom soul that you create to maintain a boundary around who you really are. It's a fence that you build. And it's a false fence. Sometimes it's a beautiful stone brick wall that's hiding a shack. Three, the ego equates having with being. We must have more to maintain this boundary of self. I can get more stuff, more stuff, more stuff. I'll be happy and secure. And you find out it doesn't work. Number four, the ego equates doing with being. We must do more to maintain the boundary of self. Whenever I read this, I think of Martha. Remember Mary and Martha, the sisters? Yeshua goes to their home, and Mary sits at Yeshua's feet. Martha's in the kitchen working. Working, 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 getting really hot under the collar, getting really upset. I'm doing all the work. My sister's in there doing nothing, just sitting at Jesus' feet. And finally, she just couldn't take it anymore, and she had to come in and say something. And Yeshua said, Martha, Martha. Or in the Amplified, it's Martha, 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 Martha. Okay? It says, and listen to what he says. He says, you are encumbered with much serving. What does that mean? You know, it seems like we're always trying to get people to serve. But you know that your service to God can be an impediment to your relationship with God? Your service to people can be an impediment to your relationship with people? Because, and when that happens, what it is, it's your ego at work. It's the boundary you've made around your soul. It's this phantom soul you've made to protect you, and it's getting in the way of any kind of real intimacy with God and with others. And then the fifth one I shared with you is the ego is the cause of all depression and unhappiness. You either figure I deserve more, and you're miserable because you don't get it. Or you think, I deserve less, and you're miserable because you don't get it. And you're always comparing yourself with others. And you're always missing who you really are. The ego is an illusory soul. It's a phantom soul. It's something you've created that isn't you. So, what I want to do is this. I don't usually like making illustrations on the overhead, because then people who listen on the internet or CDs, they don't get them, and then they whine. So I'm just going to tell them right now, if you're whining about this, it's your ego. You just need to get it under control. And there's a couple ways I could go about this. None of them are perfect. I hope it's somewhat effective. But what I'm going to do, I'm going to use my best artistic skills to draw a stick figure. There we go. This stick figure, you like that? All right. Okay. Who knows, might be hanging the... I've seen worse. I have seen worse than the Cleveland Art Museum. So this is you. The real you, the genuine you. This is you, right here, you. No falseness, no pretense, you, the way God made you. Now, it doesn't mean you're perfect. You still need to grow, you know, as you grow physically. You need to grow spiritually. You need to grow mentally and emotionally. You mature. But this is you, the true you right now. And then... over here somewhere is who you think you are. And when people first meet you, what they do, they react with the person you portray yourself to be. But you know what? This doesn't work real well when you spend much time at all with other people. Pretty soon they begin to realize, that's not you. You're over here. That's you. And when that happens, when they start to see through the ego, they see through the phantom soul, the unreal you, this illusion, then they start dealing with you on the basis of who you really are, and that causes intense pain. And that's when the friendship breaks down, the marriage breaks down, you begin to move on to another relationship. You look for another group, a new group, and then you try to fool them with the ego. And but the thing is, you're not even aware of all this. What will happen is the ego is such a deceiver. When people start to see through your ego, what you interpret it as is, well, they just don't appreciate me. They just don't really know me. The problem is they do know you. You don't know yourself. I mean, let's take a real dumb example. All right, we have young people here. Let's take a real dumb example. You know, I'm a guy, so I'll talk to the guys. You know the guy who thinks he's the world's greatest baseball player? I remember a kid I played baseball with. He thought he was the world's greatest, right? He wasn't. He wasn't even the world's goodest. He wasn't even mediocre. He was somewhere in there, but he thought he was great. And so his picture of himself as this guy who's going to be a pro. But we all saw through it. And when we didn't treat him like a pro, when he started talking about his feats on the baseball diamond and we just didn't buy it, he got really angry because he's feeling pain because we were dealing with him according to who he was, not who he portrayed himself to be. You get the idea? So you can take that little scenario, as imperfect as it is, and you can make it a business person. You can make it a pastor. You can be some Bible teacher. You can make it whoever it is. A girl who thinks she's the most beautiful woman on earth, or some person thinks they're the best musician, or they're just the coolest, or that. What? It makes no difference. But the real you is over here. The greater the distance between the real you and the fake you, the more pain you're going to experience in your life. The more pain you're going to experience in your life. And the closer these two come together, as the ego begins to shrink, and as your image of yourself comes more into line with reality, your pain decreases. And that's called humility. And you'll find that things just don't hurt so much. And you find that people deal with you according to who you really are. And that's fine. That's good. Because you know who you really are. You know you're not the best. You know you're not the worst. And you're not suffering under this illusion, under this deception of being somebody else. Okay? Rachel, or Abby, I'm sorry, I saw your hand up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. He might see herself as really good, but others don't. Mm-hmm. Or the girl who thinks she's beautiful, but others don't see her that way. What's the difference between the two?
That's a great question. What's the difference between the ego and self-confidence? I guess it all comes down to that word, that S-E-L-F, in self-confidence. Is it confidence in my ego, or is it confidence in who I truly am? And I think one of the best ways to answer that is let's look at Yeshua. Here is an individual who had no ego. There was no phantom soul there. He was who he was. You could say he is the I am incarnate. He is. There's no ego involved. You couldn't hurt his pride because he didn't have pride. Did he have self-confidence? Absolutely. He knew who he was. He knew he was the Messiah, the Son of God, and sinless. He knew that, and yet he didn't get proud about it because he knew who he was. Being humble doesn't mean you look down on yourself. It just means you don't look at yourself at all. You don't think about yourself. And Yeshua wasn't always thinking about himself, but when he did have to speak of himself, he spoke truly and accurately without ego ever getting involved in the mess. All right? It was just clear. It was light. It was true. And so when you think of Yeshua, here's a person with perfect self-confidence because he had a perfectly clear vision, untainted by deception when it came to who he was. That's how we need to be with ourselves. And when we see a gift that God's given us, recognize this is a gift from God, I'm going to invest it in his kingdom. I'm not going to deny I have it. I'm not going to say, oh no, I can't sing. I don't have the voice. I'm terrible. When you do have a voice, when you're gifted. You know? Some of the things, April Sherrick. April's not here, is she? Okay, good. So I can't embarrass her. All right. April has a beautiful voice, and many of us have heard her sing. Just wonderful voice. And what I like about April is that you can say, April, would you sing? And she'll smile, and she'll sing. She doesn't go through saying, no, I'm awful, I'm terrible, I just have an ugly voice, I haven't practiced, blah, blah, blah. She just understands she has this gift. She doesn't boast about it, but she doesn't deny that she has it. It's just she sees herself clearly. And it's wonderful. It's just refreshing. Okay? Now, to help us understand this, I want to share some things with you that to add to this information that I just reviewed with you. And so here are some principles to keep in mind. And I know the title of this slide is a little disturbing, and Satan's image. But see, you have to understand, when you operate in the ego, either thinking you're the best or the worst or you're different or whatever, that's satanic. Because that's how Satan operates. That's what's led to our problems. And it was him appealing to Adam and Eve and to their ego that we've inherited all these problems. When you operate in the ego, you are aligning yourself with the enemy. When you operate in humility, which is truth, then you are aligning yourself with God and with his kingdom. So here's some principles to keep in mind. Whatever your self-image, it is inaccurate. The question is, how inaccurate? How inaccurate? What's the distance between who you think you are and who you really are? As that distance decreases, the more you become yourself and the stronger your relations become as well. We can shift from one false self-image to another more desirable false self-image. This is what's another thing. The ego is very unstable. And you know, in the little children, especially like junior high age, they start going through puberty. I taught junior high for 18 years. And one day, a kid would come in, and that day he was a clown. He was the world's greatest jokester. That same kid would come in the next day, he's the world's greatest lover. He's Casanova. All right? He's just too cool to talk to anybody. The next day he comes in, he's something different. They're trying on all of these self-images just to kind of see what fits. Some people never outgrow that. That's what's really sad. The degree of our unhappiness is the distance between who we are and who we think we are. The degree of our unhappiness is the distance between who we are, who we think we are. When others begin to relate to us according to who we are, instead of according to our ego, our nakedness is exposed. Satan shares this same fear. He does not want you to know him for who he truly is. Satan wants you to think of you as this all-powerful being. I got news for you, he's not. He wants you to think of him as this omniscient being, omnipotent being. He isn't. He wants you to think of him as having power in your life. He doesn't. He wants you to think of you that think of him that when he comes into a person's life, their eyes glow red, you know, and they speak in a different voice and they spew green bile. That's what he wants you to think. That's not how it works. People who have this image of Satan are people who are deceived. They're unstable. They have weak minds. Do not think of the enemy this way. He is not powerful. What he is, he's a serpent that has a mouth and he lies. That is his one and only tool. He uses it very well. As our self-image begins to resemble our true self, our relationships with others also grow stronger. Because we're not relating them according to our ego, we're relating them according to who we really are. You can really build a relationship on that. I tell you, here's a recipe for a disastrous marriage. Take one person, here's their ego, and here's the other person with their ego, and let the egos intermingle. Let the egos marry. And a lot of people marry because they're marrying their egos together, and yet the two of them are still miles apart. You talk about a recipe for a rotten marriage, one that's not going to last. And if it does, God help us all. One of the wonderful things about marriage is it should help destroy the ego. I heard some giggles there. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? One of the things marriage will do, it will reveal the unselfishness. It will reveal the selfishness in your life. And how you respond to that knowledge will determine the direction of your marriage. I have a quote from you. Your only mistake is you confuse me with you. That's a quote from Satan. How do I get that quote from him? I found an autobiography he wrote. I did. I can't recommend the book. I found an autobiography of Satan. I can't recommend it. I'm not going to tell you who the ghostwriter was for this. Because after all, it's written by the devil and it's got some distortions and lies in it. But I tell you what, there's some powerful insight here. Listen to this one. This is what when I opened this book, I thought, this is interesting. I opened it up, I read a couple remarks, and I turned out buying it. And this is one of the things. I've done my job, Satan says. I've done my job of opposing you a little too well, and you haven't done your job of resisting me well enough. As a result, we're falling behind schedule. You see, the reason Satan wrote this autobiography, he tells you in the foreword, is that God created him for a purpose. And the purpose for Satan's existence is so that we would have something to resist. And if there is nothing to resist in our walk of coming to God and growing spiritually, there's nothing to resist, we would never get strength, we could never get reward. God has sent the enemy here. God created him knowing what he would do, and God still chose to do it, so there must be something of benefit for us, for Satan to exist. And so Satan's coming forward his autobiography and saying, it's true. I do have a purpose in your life. My purpose in your life is to resist you, to throw smoke in your eyes, to try to get you off, because this way, as you resist me, you get stronger, you become more like your Creator, and there's reward for you in the world to come. This is a brilliant statement. People of every race can serve God on one condition. They have to believe. If you don't believe God exists, then how can you serve God? That's one limitation I don't have. You do not have to believe in me in order to serve me. What I want you to do is I want to expose Satan to you, using his own words, so that you can know who he is. Tell you what, we're going to take a brief break here. Let's go to Psalm 139 for a second. Psalm 139. Because what I'm sharing with you, even though I'm going to be quoting this autobiography of the devil, which I know sounds really bizarre, but welcome to Beth Dacoum, where the bizarre is normal, and the normal is bizarre. Okay. Psalm 139. Now, as you go through this psalm, it's a beautiful psalm. It's a very intimate psalm. But then you come to a few verses here, four verses that just don't seem to belong. There's a block of verses here. And if those verses weren't in the psalm, you would not notice their absence. You'll recognize them as soon as we get to them. I'm just going to read through it. But I want you to pay attention to the intimacy here of David taking a look, like along with God, David standing by God and looking into himself. Listen to what he says. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down are intimately acquainted with all of my ways. Even before there's a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. You have enclosed me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you're there. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me and your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me and the light around me will be night. Well, even the darkness is not dark to you. And the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. For you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. In other words, God knows you really, really, really well. But look what he says next. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed, for they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with the utmost hatred. They have become my enemies. And then you get back on track. Like he has this little tantrum, and then he gets back on track. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any hurtful way in me. And lead me in the everlasting way. What's the bit with those four verses? They don't belong. Until you realize, at least this is what I believe, that in those four verses, David's not jumping outside of himself and talk about the enemies across the street or in the next town or in the next country. He is talking about the enemies in him. The whole psalm is about how God has woven him together, put him together, knitted him together. He knows his thoughts. He knows his words before he speaks them. He knows his days before he's even born. Every detail. And yet, there's a squatter in my life. There's an enemy within, and I hate it. I despise it. God, destroy it. And search me. Search me throughout. And let's eradicate this enemy from my life. You know, we've been reading the Torah, and the people are getting ready to go into the promised land. And what's the commandments? Is all through here. You've got to drive out and kill, destroy every individual who's squatting there. You've got to eradicate the land of them, because if you don't, there'll be a thorn in your side. You will learn their ways. They will lead you astray. They will seduce you. They will take you away from intimacy with me. And they're right there in the land, your land, my land, where we are going to live together. They're there, and it's up to you to get rid of them. I've got news for you. When he's teaching Israel about the land, He's teaching each one of us about life in this body made of dirt. And there's enemies we have to eradicate. So let me read to you from Satan's autobiography. I think you'll find it enlightening. You don't have to agree with everything here. After all, the devil wrote it. But as he exposes himself, his tactics, listen to what he says. He says, I am your ego. My vocation is an essential part of God's plan. The soul was cast out of Eden to experience pain in order to awaken appreciation for the paradise that is God. And there are two ways to experience pain. You can experience it, or I can experience it for you. I'll be more specific. There are two ways to know the pain of this world. One, through the decimation, the destruction of your ego and all self-interest. Or two, through pain inflicted on your body and soul. Here's what Satan's saying. And if we had time to read more, he's saying, your ego, it's really me. And I'm like your stunt double. You're the star of the movie, right? But when something dangerous happens in the movie, the star steps out and somebody looks like him steps in. And he says, here's what happens. When trouble comes in your life, you can let it beat up your ego, which is me. Or if you want to clean your ego, you can experience the pain directly. Here's how it works. Someone insults you, says something terribly about you to your face. I'm just taking one example. They say something to you, and it's just, and it's unfair. You can either let your ego take the beating, or you can take the beating. If you let the ego take the beating, you feel the pain from a distance, and you let the ego undergo destruction, and you become more free. But if you identify with the ego, you feel the pain, you get angry, your blood pressure goes up, you start thinking hateful thoughts, the enemy's got you wrapped right there around his little finger. Think of the ego as Satan and as your stunt double. And when pain comes to your life, let him take the beating. Let your ego take the beating, because it's your enemy anyhow. That's a brilliant insight. Hope you can take hold of that. So he goes on. I go back to the quotes. Life throws you a curveball. You either allow me, the ego, to become frustrated and worried, or you will. Life throws you a sinker ball. The ego gets depressed, or you will. Someone desperately needs financial assistance. You either give until it hurts me, or you hang on to your money and the self-gratification that comes with greed and allow it to hurt you. In other words, all kinds of garbage will hit you throughout your life. You either let the ego be sad, depressed, ashamed, or hurt, or you will experience sadness, depression, madness, aggravation, and a whole lot of hurt. Great lyrics for a country song, I might add. After a lifetime of living with your fellow man, either the ego dies or you die. Did you catch that? Either the ego dies or you die. Catch that last one? I slipped it in without much fanfare. Here it is again. Death occurs for one reason. You fail to let the ego die. What is death, by the way? This is me, not Satan, talking. What is death, by the way? It's separation from God. You know what separates you from God? Your ego. Because that's where your Yetzirah dwells, that's where sin dwells, that's where pride dwells, that's where false humility dwells, that's where it all exists. As the ego dies, you begin to really start to live. All right, we'll pick up where Satan left off. But before we move on, you might still be confused about this notion of ego. After all, I have spent millennia attempting to distort its true meaning. Your ego is your reactive response to the world. Your ego is your reactive response to the world. For instance, you react to failure and get depressed. That is your ego. You respond to success and develop a swelled head. That's ego too. You react to an opportunity and feel, oh, you're just not good enough to seize it. Believe it or not, that is also ego. You seize an opportunity, pushing everyone else aside without regard for the pain you cause them. Ego strikes again. You are selfish. Ego. You give charity and let everyone know about it. Ego. Someone takes up a belief that is contrary to yours and you lock horns. Ego on both sides. Someone espouses an argument or belief that you agree with and you will follow along blindly. Ego, ego, ego. Someone tells you the truth and you reject it. This is the most common form of ego on the planet. I do hope you're catching on. The ego's job is to motivate you to react. Everything you do at the ego's request in life is a knee-jerk reaction. I don't care what the trigger is or what your intention is. Your ego sees to it that you're always reacting to someone or something, and I am the one enticing your behavior or inciting your behavior. That means that all of the negative thoughts in your head are mine. However, because I've disguised myself so ingeniously in your ego, you think those thoughts are yours. And therein lies your problem. Now, right now, the enemy's whispering you, thinking, I don't know that that's scriptural. All right, well, let's look at the scriptures. Matthew 16. Go to Matthew 16. I mean, I know the enemy's whispering thoughts in your minds. Well, I just don't know about that. Why doesn't he just teach the word? Why don't we get back to the Torah? Matthew 16 is a wonderful story. Yeshua is with his disciples, and he asks, who do people say that I, the Son of Man, am? And then they give different answers. And Peter's silent. He's listening to the conversation, right? He's listening. Somebody says, oh, somebody says you're this. Another says, oh, somebody says you're this. And then he says, well, who do you say that I am? And verse 16, Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Yeshua said to him, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And then he speaks about the gates of Hades and the keys of the kingdom. And then verse 20, just for sake of time. Verse 21, from that time, Yeshua began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed to be raised up on the third day. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord. This shall never happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. Did Peter's eyes glow red? Did his voice change? Did green bile start leaking out of the corner of his mouth? Did his head spin around? No. And Yeshua defines for us Satan's tactics. Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but Satan's. Is that what it says? No, 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 no. He says, for you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but man's. You see, and the first question, who do men say that I am? Peter's listening. He's thinking. Who do you say that I am? Peter says, you're the Messiah. You're the Son of the Living God. Well done, Peter. But here, when Peter hears something he does not want to hear, he reacts. And Yeshua refers to him as Satan. Because you are thinking man's way and not God's way. This is a most powerful insight into how Satan works. You don't have to think like the devil to speak his words. All you have to do is think like a man. Think human thoughts instead of godly thoughts. Just act natural. That's all you have to do. Yes, sir. Very, very possibly, which again is man's way of doing things. Yeah, very possibly. And you know, we could also look later on where Yeshua, at the Last Supper, he comes to wash the disciples' feet, right? And so he's going along, washing their feet, comes to Peter, you'll never wash my feet. See how ego is working here? I'm not good enough for you to wash my feet. Listen, if the Master, the Messiah, the Son of God, walks toward you with a bowl of water and a towel and says, I'm going to wash your feet, you let him wash your feet. He's the Master. He's the Messiah. He's the Son of God. He's taking initiative. Don't you dare react out of your ego. You submit to what he wants to do for you. And then watch what Peter's ego does next. Because Yeshua says, if I don't wash your feet, you're not part of me. Oh, then wash me all over then. No, 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 Peter. Just the feet. You see? See how the ego fools us? All right, we're going to pick it back up here. Let's get back to Satan. You don't hear that in church often, do you? All right. Satan says, the more humiliated the ego is, the better off you are. The more humiliated the ego is, the better off you are. See, this is one of the wonderful things about being part of a community. Our job in this community is to beat up your ego. That's what we're here for. We don't mean to. It just happens. It's natural. You know, you see houses where it says, beware of dog in the front yard. I think churches have signs, beware of sheep. Because we sheep have a way of nipping each other, biting each other, and behaving badly. And God uses that. God uses that, even though we don't intend to. Even though we're operating in our egos, God is still using that to break yours. All right. Satan continues, I play hard, which means you get my very best every time out. It has to be this way. If it were easy for you, if it took no effort on your part to find me and defeat me, you'd earn nothing. And nothing would have changed since you lost paradise. You need to experience growing pains because that is the only way you can appreciate the infinite happiness that is your destiny. There's no way around it. That's why I have to use every trick in the book, every means possible to make it difficult for you and to find me. And remember, I do this for your own good. Without me, you won't have an opponent in the game, which means winning would be meaningless. Would you like to know a shortcut to kicking the pain habit? Simple. Renounce selfishness. Selfishness is a tool specifically designed to inflict repeated pain upon yourself. Sure, when you renounce selfishness, it'll hurt like Gehenna. But that fleeting pain is the only pain you'll have to experience. There's your magic formula. Yep, that's the ticket. Give selfishness the boot and say hello to eternal life. You know, we read Matthew 16, and we ended at verse 23. If you read the next verse, Yeshua is saying the same thing here. 16:24, Yeshua said to his disciples, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Deny himself. Cross, take that up. That's an instrument of death. You've got to die to the ego, die to the self, die to thinking like a normal human being and begin to think like God. And look at the next verse, verse 25. For whoever wishes to save his life, they're going to lose it. You could put it this way. Whoever wishes to hang on to his ego, he's going to die. But whoever loses it, loses his life for my sake, will find it. So we'll pick up where we left off. Satan says, this is a good time for me to mention that I, myself, am the epitome of selfishness. In fact, selfishness would be my middle name if I had one. My job is to incite within you selfish behavior in all its manifestations. Egocentricity, self-indulgence, self-centeredness, low self-esteem, poor self-image, depression, anger, jealousy, worry, fear, accusation. Believe it or not, these are all different expressions of selfishness. Your task is to reject it, overcome it, resist it. My job is to convince you to embrace it with open arms. As you begin to renounce selfishness and overcome ego, gradually you come to the realization that the ego is not you. Not an easy task, but when you do get there, you're happy that I am the one going through hell and not you. When you reach a level of wisdom, let's call it a state of awareness, where you genuinely understand that it is me behind your ego, you'll be excited to put an end to the game for good. The reason a grown man fears the death of his ego more than he fears physical death is because he mistakes the ego for himself. He doesn't know it's me, his real enemy. He doesn't know that if ego dies, he lives. Be honest with yourself. If you actually knew right now that I was real, that I was the cause of your pain, you'd send me packing. This is why I work so hard to convince you I don't exist. If you really knew the truth, you'd welcome humiliation. You'd keep your big mouth shut when that arrogant, swaggering, loudmouth friend of yours runs his mouth off. You'd stop yourself from one-upping him because you'd know it was me inside of you who was really pushing your buttons. Excuse me. The thought of surrendering the ego is terrifying, but the fearsome threat is just a mirage. It is I who conjure up the fear, injecting it into every cell in your body. Thanks to me, facing this fear can seem almost impossible, but it isn't. Not only is it entirely possible, but overcoming your fear and squaring off against your ego is a very smart play, a winning move without question. But if you choose the alternative route of protecting the ego, you will suffer instead. Sickness, disease, emotional turmoil, financial instability, wrecked marriages, ruined relationships, chronic depression, death. You know the routine. You know it well, all too well. As long as you fail to make the separation between the real you and the real me, you will wind up taking on every ounce of pain throughout your entire life. This is the way it's been since the dawn of human consciousness. Now you have it. My complete game plan. I'm busted. But a bit more. First off, know that you'll never get a test that you can't handle. And that's what 1 Corinthians 10:13 says. And Satan says there are two important things to keep in mind. Number one, within every test, and we're always tested, within every test, always be on the lookout for me. Think of each test as a page from Where's Waldo? I'll always be there somewhere. Need a clue? Where selfishness is rearing its pretty head, you are sure to find me. Number two, think of the other person. With any test you encounter, let me tell you that the odds are in your favor. The odds are in your favor. But just because God is on your side doesn't mean you should ever ask to be tested. Ask for a test and the odds change big time. Talk about ask and you shall receive. I'll enter your consciousness with a force you are not prepared to handle. Only God knows when you are ready. So let God decide when to send me and to do my job. And God will. Because God knows you cannot increase the size of your vessel without test. You can't grow your soul without it being tested. You can't go back to Kansas without confronting the wicked witch that is your selfish nature. I will tell you this much. There are two types of test I might throw your way. There is the one-shot deal. Blow it and you're done. And the other is my personal favorite, the slow burn. Just the mere sound of these brings me great excitement. With a one-shot deal, my goal is to hit you with one singular life experience that packs such a powerful punch, it leaves you shattered under the sheer unfairness of it all. The slow burn speaks for itself. With this test, I wear you down slowly. Over time, I corrupt your consciousness. You don't even know that it's happening. It's like the frog in the boiling water experiment. Drop a frog into a pot of nice, cool water, then gradually bring that water to a boil. Then sit back as the frog cooks up nice and hearty. But if you drop that same frog into a pot of boiling water, he'll jump ship in a heartbeat. In that same way, I prefer the oh-so-slow and steady line of attack. It takes a great deal of patience on my part, but the payoff is that you never see it coming. By the way, I will never let you know the weight of the test in the big picture. You will never know if you're taking a final exam or a mere quiz. So beware. Sometimes a small test is really a big test in disguise. I freely admit it. I'm a sucker for disguises. You might know this one. You're already in a committed relationship, and then an attractive single person of the opposite sex asks you for a cup of coffee. You're excited about it. Hello, is there such a thing as a simple cup of coffee? Check yourself out. What are you looking for? What's up with your relationship that you are out with someone else for a cup of coffee? Can you see me hiding in this scenario? What lack am I activating in you? What am I feeding you besides coffee? What about being asked out makes you feel good? It's not the caffeine. Is it receiving attention from another person? Is it me? Note this. If you create an opening for me, I will step in, and you probably won't like where I take you. Sometimes the most seemingly harmless decisions are wrought with life-changing consequences, so prepare accordingly. On the flip side, sometimes you think you're being given the ultimate test, but the truth is that's hardly a test at all. Call it a pop quiz at best. Say you're out of town on a business trip, and an attractive business associate of the opposite sex asks you to join him or her in his room or her room later. You decline and walk away, proud of yourself for resisting such a tempting offer. But how great was the temptation, really? You have a wonderful spouse at home, great kids, comfortable life. You might have been flattered by the other, but turning it down didn't cost you much. That doesn't mean that you passed the test. It just means that it wasn't much of a test in the first place. Or maybe it was another kind of test. Where am I hiding? In your pride over passing the test? Am I hiding in your righteousness? But you will fail. No one's going to pass every test all the time. It's the practice that makes for perfection, remember? To win, you have to fail a few times. It's like the major league batter who makes it into the Hall of Fame for hitting 700 home runs in his career. Imagine how many times the guy swung and missed, fouled out, or was thrown out. Yet, he's one of the best in the history of the game. Sure, it's easy for baseball players because they know what they need to do. But you will suffer mistakes and misfires. Your job is to refuse to get bogged down by them. That is to say, failure is part of the journey. Failure is part of the grand design. It's an integrated component on the motherboard of life. You can't simply remove it or the function it serves. In fact, the only real failure comes when you fail to grow from the challenges you come up against. And then we'll finish. But there is some good news here. There is an alternative, and it's called letting go. Let go of the ego, and I'll let go of you. I'll let you keep the happiness and fulfillment that is your birthright if you will let go of the notion that you are not worthy of having this joy. When you let go of me, I let go of you. It's a powerful game we are playing, and you are playing against the master. Are you having fun yet? I had to share that with you. I debated back and forth, but since I had to share these insights into our enemy's tactics. And with this information, as you read the scriptures, you're going to see him interweaving with the characters of the word. And you're going to see how Yeshua never failed because he knew the Torah and he quoted it. He uses the word of God as his strength to counter the tactics of the enemy. Remember, knowing the enemy is like the Where's Waldo books. He's in there hiding. And even when you pass a test, the test keeps going. How are you dealing with your success? That's also a test, right? And so be aware of this. This is how our enemy works. Is he powerful? Nope. He's just a really good liar. But if we know the truth will make us free. Our sword of the Spirit is the word of God, the word of truth. Right? You put on your armor. All that armor has to do with truth. We're going to close with one last passage. I know we've gone over a bit, but I'm still milking 2 weeks ago when I quit early. And I get as much mileage out of that as I can. And, well, it's in 2 Corinthians 10. Ken, go ahead. I saw your hand up while we're turning there. Why don't you go ahead and share? Yes. Yeah, that's what a living sacrifice is. Instead of giving my life to serve my ego, my idea of who I should be, let me just give myself up to God and let Him make me who He wants me to be. Yeah, this is give ourselves away completely to Him. If I hold on to my life, I'm going to lose it. If I let go of it for His sake, I find it. All right, 2 Corinthians 10, verse 3, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely power for the destruction of fortresses." What are the fortresses? Here they are, three of them. We are destroying speculations. Where do speculations come in? Where do the thoughts come in? In our brains, in our minds. You have to remember that not all the thoughts that are in your mind are your thoughts. Your mind is like a radio, and the signal's coming from outside of you. So many times the thoughts you think are your thoughts, you start beating yourself up for them. They're not yours. You're receiving a signal from the enemy. What's the second thing? We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. Where does knowledge of God dwell? In the mind. And then the third thing, we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Messiah. Again, the mind. See, these thoughts, here's good news for you. You beat yourself up because you have wicked thoughts. It's like beating up the radio because there's a bad broadcaster down the street sending signals to it. What you do is you take the thought captive and say, no, I'm not going to listen to that, and you change stations. That's what you do. If there's a bad song coming out of your radio, don't break the radio. Tune it to another station. Don't take ownership of the wicked thoughts that come into your mind. But then, like the old Sunday school teacher told me years ago, I think it's the only thing I remember from her, is she said, "You might not be able to keep a bird from landing in your hair, right, landing on your head, but you can keep it from building a nest in your hair." So in other words, take the thought captive. Say, no, 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 you're not going to control me. I'm going to take control of you. Where did you come from? And sometimes it can be a good thought. Think, oh, I got this great idea. Well, maybe it's not a great idea. Don't react. Take it captive. Shine a bright light in its eyes as you duct tape it to a chair and ask, "Where did you come from? Who are you, a spy? Whose side are you on?" And then decide to incarcerate it or to free it. One or the other. But this is where the war is. It's in our minds. Our enemy's tool is his mouth. But the weapons of our warfare, far superior. We'll just use them. We just use them. David, we're going to give you the last word. Yeah. Sure.
But personally, he probably doesn't even know why.
Exactly. When we use the term Satan here, see, in the spiritual realm, a thing is called what it's called if it imitates something else. All right? So when we work according to the spirit of self, the spirit of ego, the word just calls it Satan because that's how he operates, you see. So when we behave like Yeshua, we become Christians, little messiahs, so to speak. Are we the Messiah? No, 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 no. But as our lives start looking like His, then we begin to take on His name. And so when our lives start looking like Satan's, we take on His name. And this is the way He works. Because our parents sinned and we inherited death from them, we inherit this ability to hear exactly the kind of argument Satan gave them. We hear that all the time. It's always coming in. And but God knew that. And he gave us the wherewithal to have victory over it and to become stronger by it. And I hope these words don't discourage you, but encourage you to, like, yeah, I'm going to let my ego take a beating so I don't have to. I'm going to let go of that. Beat my ego up. Fine, have at it. Because that's my stunt double. And that's my enemy anyhow. You beat up my ego, then you're the enemy of my enemy, which makes you my friend. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time. Lord, there's so much more that could be said, but I pray you'll take these words. May they enter into our hearts and minds and open our eyes so we'll know the tactics of our enemy and that we will be as innocent as doves, yet wise as serpents. But the enemy has one tactic, that's to lie to us, to deceive us, for us to believe that his lies are actually the truth and act as if they are true. Lord, help us not to be deceived. Help us to see ourselves as you see us. Search us, Father. Search our hearts and see if there's any wicked way in us and open our eyes to see it and get rid of it because it's foreign matter. It's not who we are. And Lord, help us to drive the enemy out of our land, out of our hearts, our minds, our souls, our emotions, and help us not to be reactive, but obedient to you. And Lord, we're counting on you to help us to do this because this is your desire for us. And we ask it in Yeshua's name. Amen.